Good morning, sir. Before we get started, now, what is your name, sir?
What is that?
I missed it.
I didn't quite hear you, sir.
Ingersoll.
Okay, Mr. Ingersoll, if you can just hold on for a few moments and speak into the phone, and the Honorable Mr. David Neal will be conducting your hearing, so just hang on, and we'll be with you very shortly, sir. But please speak up, because we're having some problems, some audio problems this morning. So, Honorable Mr. Neal will be with you shortly, sir.
Good morning, sir. Can you hear me okay? Okay. We're preparing for the original board of deputy clemency this morning in reference to the parole hearing. Let me introduce the board members that will be conducting a hearing at this time. On the screen to your far left is the Honorable Michael Johnson. Then the Honorable Gail Rittenhouse, the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, who's our board chairman. To your far right on the screen is the Honorable Louis Canonis. My name is David Neal. I'll be the hearing aide. Hey, this morning, sir, we're going to go over some information. I'll verify it with you as we go, and then we'll go into a back and forth discussion and see how things go, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, so would you state your full name and agency number for the record, please?
My name is John Cameron Ingersoll,
and my agency number is 08910. Thank you, sir. All right, so you were 71 years old now?
No, I was 72 in March.
Okay. And you're serving a life sentence for first-degree murder, which began on October 21st, 1990. You became parole eligible on October 21st, 2015. And you were certified for this hearing for regular parole, home arrest, or absolute discharge on November 9th, 2018. You appeared before the board four times previously, and you've always been denied. That sound correct so far, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I did not find a current progress report, which would include your release plan and all that kind of information today, so hopefully, there aren't anything issues that would be on it that would change the hearing, so we'll continue. So the crime that you're convicted of and you're serving time on in October of 1990, you were eventually charged and convicted of murdering Robert Manley. He was last seen in his apartment October 9, 1990. He was reported missing after he failed to appear at work at a job installation in California. At the victim's apartment, police located his wallet, keys, and his truck, which was packed with tools and luggage. During the investigation, you were contacted and they found blood stains in your truck. And that the motive that they found for you to want to have killed this man was that you believed that he was having an affair with his wife. Does that sound correct so far, sir?
That was the most correct.
Okay, I can't understand you, sir.
Bob didn't have anything to do with females. That has nothing to do with my intent. But that was the prosecution's theory, yes.
Okay. Well, you know, I said that that, you know, investigation led to you when you were charged and convicted. Haven't got far enough to discuss your claims at the time. But to this day, I guess they haven't discovered the body.
Well, I was convicted and there was no crime scene, no matter if she might have died.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll go through that a little bit more as we go through here, sir. Okay. So that's the basis of the crime. There were a man was ended up missing. His blood was found, and the investigation led to, I believe it was an indictment against you, and you were convicted of the crime, and that's the sentence you were doing, and that's what we're here to talk about. So, your criminal history goes back to 1965 in Kalamazoo, Michigan, with some large-needs drunk disorder. Missoula, Montana, discharging of firearm, drugs. Now, not all of these were convictions. Some were just arrests. So we'll have that issue of discussion as we go through this. Normally, if you're arrested, there's probable cause to believe that you committed the crime. You can be found not guilty. They can dismiss them. They can do whatever, but you were arrested on suspicion of these crimes, okay? I'm not saying you were convicted of all of them. I know that you have had issues in the past with wording on things like that. So, in San Jose, California, got arrested for a probation violation out of Montana for one of the charges you were convicted of. Then Scott Ferraroni had a DUI and obstructing, which was, I believe that one was dismissed. And then Phoenix, there was an assault, and then this offense. Okay. Now, like I said, I don't have a current progress report, so I'm not sure what plans, if any, you had as far as release go. But we'll discuss that. Seems like you had some pretty good programming in which you're a fairly talented artist. Some of the pictures that we have in our packet are quite good, sir, and I must commend you on your artistic abilities. Also on your having gone to the trouble of taking the programming you've taken. Also in the past, you've had good community support, but there's nothing actually current for this hearing, no updated letters or anything else like that. I don't believe anybody is here in support of you today in the boardroom. But you've had good community support, halfway houses, things like that, that have said that they would take you if you are ever released. So that's very commendable, too. And we do have a letter of opposition from the Maricopa County Attorney's Office that is dated December 31st, 2018. And they're adamantly against any kind of release for you at this time. So, Mr. Ingersoll, let's talk a little bit. I understand that at the time this all occurred, you said that you had nothing to do with the victims being missing, and because they have no body, you claimed that he might not even be dead, and you didn't do anything. Is that still your stance, sir, that you didn't have anything to do with the offense you were convicted of?
No, it's not. It should be in the record. I'm an addict, and I have a moon date of 1979. I haven't used any substance at all since that time, but my prior history, I became an alcoholic at the age of 12 years old. And I basically was a drug addict for, until 1979. 2 years prior to my arrest for this crime, I was involved in a head-on car wreck that gave me a C5, 4, 5, 5, 6, 6, 7 spinal injury and an MRI showed that the whole front of my brain was just a pool of blood. For 2 years prior to this crime, I was trained a few times a week and very little was done to help me. I literally got to where I was a lunatic. I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't function as a human being, and I was out of my mind. The police reports upon my arrest indicate that. I was a blackout drunk. I have no education in brain theory, psychology, anything like that. But I have no recollection at the time of my arrest of having committed this crime. And I believe that I was innocent. Circumstances surrounding the crime indicated that the blood evidence that was used against me were two tiny spots on the undercarriage of my truck. Even the blood evidence that they presented were type A blood, Bob had type O blood. All the blood evidence in the cab of my truck was type A blood. In 2006, I had a stroke where I was literally unable to talk, unable to use the left side of my body. And after that, I started having the most dynamic dreams that I've ever had in my life. And part of that dreaming was circumstances concerning Bob and my participation in that. To this day, I have no recollection of actually killing Bob, but I have come to believe that I did kill Bob and I did dispose of his body. I tried my best to show that to two famous police officers in 2012 where Bob was located. They came to see me twice. Apparently they didn't find his body. I don't know what else to do with it. Bob was a friend of mine. I was the hospitals and the institutions chair for Narcotics Anonymous at the time of my arrest, or just prior to my arrest. And Bob was the regional agent chair. I loved Bob, I had sponsored Bob. Bob did not have relations with women. I did not believe that Bob was having an affair with my wife. What I did believe was because I didn't, with my spinal injury, I did not know what pain was until I had this injury. And it literally drove me out of my mind. But because I'm an addict, and I know what pain medication does to a person like this, I refused to take it. All I took was aspirin. And literally, I don't know the right or wrong or anything like that, but it literally overwhelmed me. And I became delusional. Politics and everything, there's politics and recovery. And I became so delusional that I believe that Bob was in with other people in Narcotics Anonymous who were against me. And when I saw Bob, I was upset with him because of that, because of my delusional political theories of recovery. And as I've said, I do not remember actually killing Bob, but I know I argued with him, there was a conflict. After my stroke, I had these recollections of driving up towards Lake Pleasant, and I believe that I know what happened. But as far as at the time of my arrest, I was The police were talking to me, like, you don't know somebody who were looking at this. They were talking to me by the way. And I was concerned about whatever was going on there. And I refused to believe that I killed my friend. And I don't know how to explain it any more clearly than that.
Okay, well, so I can't find the words to explain what I just said. Now, okay, I understand what you're saying. So at the time all this happened in your mind, you didn't have any, you didn't believe that you had anything to do with it. But since then, you've come to the conclusion that you did, and you made an attempt to try to give information so they can find the body, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
There were two places that didn't seem up, and we got on Google Maps, and I tried to point to the area that I believed the Bob was.
Okay.
And they never got back to me, and then I contacted them a couple times to see if there was anything more I could do. I don't know what that position is, or what other than the fact that they came to see me twice. We got on Google Maps, and I tried to point to the area.
Okay. With this, you're saying about your brain injury and then your stroke and everything, do you take medication on a regular basis for mental health purposes, or are things okay now?
My spinal injury amazingly, one of the doctors that I went to was Dr. Lossick at the DEMA. And she made me manipulations like a chiropractor would. I got massages 3 times a week, which is the time I thought. Before I got massages, I didn't realize how helpful that was. And she was a charity bodybuilder, and she had a gym attached to her offices, and she would put me on specific exercise routines. By 1997, as a prison here, I wasn't able to use my right arm and stuff like that. But there were two youngsters on the yard, and I asked them to help me get into shape with recollection of what this appeal had happened to me. And one of the girls was in the uniform. I'm not quite sure, it's not really popular with everybody. But it's a physical thing, body, mind, spirit type of thing, and I can relate to that because in the 12-step program, it's all about gaining a relationship with our power, becoming mentally and physically aware of that, those things on those terms. And I was able to do the yoga and the exercise to help with these feelings and to get back into physical shape. Like I said before, I'm scared to death of using drugs because I don't know what they're supposed to do. And for the last 30-some years, the only thing I think is that, and 12-step program and exercise are what I can do this for me.
Okay, well, sir, like I said before, I don't have a current progress report that would give us an idea of what your release plan would be at this time. If the board saw fit to release you now, where would you stay?
There's a place in the old temple over here in Tucson. There's the miners have one of the best halfway houses in Arizona. And I have all the support of both AA and NA. I used to be the HNI chairman of hospitals and institutions. I'm fully committed to the idea of understanding that I would like my life's terms and becoming a better person. They have meetings here. My father should show that I kind of made a little chair. I was 20 years down the road with the Yuba prison, and for most of the time I was the person who ran the 12-step program and the mutual meetings here and all that kind of stuff. I
Certifications, but they want, you know, current, well, check for current information and make sure there's a bed available and all those things, because they're not going to put you out homeless after the amount of time you spend incarcerated. Another question.
I don't want to be put out on the street, sir, because 20 years is a long time.
Right, well, that's. Well, some inmates just want out. They really don't care where they go. They want to get out. And that's not a good way to go back into the community. So it's commendable that you've already talked to some of the, you know, the halfway houses. And I know Oak Pueblo is one of the better ones around. So that's all good. The other thing that we always ask, too, the Department of Corrections has a thing about finances, and they want you to be able to show that you've got financial support for at least 2 months when you get out, so that, because it takes a while to find a job. And some of the programs, I don't know about Old Pueblo, but some of the programs you go into, the only work you can do for a while is for them, you know, on their facilities or other nonprofits that need some help. So it's not. You know, the support part is the halfway house itself, but Department of Corrections wants to make sure that you're not going to be out there and then not have any money and have to resort to feedery or something so that you can eat. Do you have any family, sir?
Yes, I've got a sister in Michigan. We have a really good relationship with her. She helps me more as a kid. I've got a son and an older sister in Northern California. I haven't had any contact with my son for a while. He's upset with me. It's hard to deal with the day he's in prison. His mother lives with him, and we've always had our differences. He's a good boy. He protects his mother. My older sister is 78 now. And she's not in very good health. I'm really not too sure what was on the...
Okay.
I have a cousin who lives up in Parkdale, but one of the last couple of years, Parkinson's has been, he's been concerned with his life. He was a sub for the community board and his money through his...
Okay. So you don't have any family in Arizona to give you support?
Well, other than my cousin up there, his Parkinson's has been becoming worse and worse. He's simply ill, so...
Okay, so once, if we saw fit to release you, and you go into a halfway house, and they let you work outside that halfway house, what would you be doing to support yourself, sir?
I'm working since I was 12, sir, and I've been working until the day I die. I'm 72, and I can stand the pull-ups, and I'm in very good health for my age. I worked building things most of my life. I've always been an outside kind of guy. But I have a very good background in recovery program, in substance abuse, and I'm quite sure what the kind of credits like the position is there. I'm a math credit and an English credit away from having a BS out of Northern Arizona Community College. So.
Okay. And I'm going to see if my fellow board members have any questions at this time. Mr. Canonis?
Thank you. Mr. Neal. Mr. Ingersoll?
Yes, sir.
I think it's important to restate that we're not here to retry the case. And I do appreciate that you've shown some responsibility and ownership for the offense in question. I'm just curious about something, and that is that you made reference to the blood evidence and stated that there was very little blood evidence. You said it was at the bottom of the vehicle?
Yes, sir.
The reason I'm asking is because the pre-sentence investigation, which again is not the official investigation, makes reference to blood evidence and both inside and outside the vehicle. Again, it's the pre-sentence investigation, not the homicide report. And I think you also spoke of some differences with the blood type. So if you believe at this point that you committed this crime, what exactly were you referring to with the blood evidence?
I don't want to confuse things all up, but I was arrested because another member of Narcotics Anonymous came to the police and said that I confessed to him. And what he said I confessed was that I shot Bob in the cab of my truck with a .44 Magnum, which I don't know, I don't know what you mean. And that pistol was loaded with 230 grain lab. And I don't know if you know anything about ballistics or not, but a .44 Magnum was one of the most powerful handguns in the world. 230 grain live fire is a hollow point type bullet that would literally, this is a picture that I want you to imagine. If I took a pistol, I'm right-handed, and I'm in the driver's seat, you're in the passenger seat of the pickup truck. If I took a long-term pistol in my right hand, I would have to put it up next to you to fire it. It would eviscerate you and it would put two holes. He said I shot him twice. It would put two holes through the door of the truck. The cab of my truck would literally be a blood bath. And I knew at the time that that was impossible. My truck was a work truck, it wasn't clean, but there wasn't any blood in it, and it didn't have two blood holes in the door. So just from my perspective, my state of mind, I was very confused, I was very hurt for this injury. I literally was insane, but that didn't make sense to me. I couldn't have done that. And I still have the police reports in my cell, and I can mail to you a document that describes what was found as a problem.
Well, Mr. Ingersoll, just out of respect to you and the process, I, as I stated at the beginning of the question, we're not here to retry the case. I was just trying to understand where you were going with that. I think I'm getting it. And tell me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like that you're taking responsibility for the crime. What you're saying is that the way the crime was described in the courts was not necessarily accurate.
Yes, I'm just trying to explain to you my confusion, because what I was told I did, I don't understand the brain enough to explain this thing to myself. I was a blackout drunk, and with my injury, whatever it was, I honestly do not recall killing Bob. But when I was charged with what the police said I did, I knew it couldn't be true. So that just reinforced my denial. It just made me believe that somehow or another this was wrong. And I'm not, in no way, shape, or form am I trying to excuse my behavior. It was very hard for me to talk about this because I love Bob. Bob was a friend of mine. I had sponsors and a friend.
Mr. Ingersoll, Mr. Ingersoll, if I may, I'm certainly not trying to harass you with these questions, and I haven't quite heard excuses coming from you either. I've heard you take responsibility for the crime. I was just trying to figure out what you meant when you were making references to the ballistic evidence, and it makes more sense to me now. I'll ask you a very direct question. Do you think it would have helped your standing with the state if a body was recovered?
Well, it would help me lose, I guess. My understanding of the law is that it's just this competition, you know? And I think I just get the feeling of it just to me because I didn't produce value or privacy. But that was, my intent was never that. I honestly believe that I was wrongly convicted. And it wasn't until I had this stroke. I had the most intense dreams that I've ever had in my life, about 90 days after that. And part of them were recollections or images or however you want to describe them, of my participation in what happened to Bob. And it just was overwhelming, you know? I mean, for years I told myself that I hadn't done this.
Thank you, Mr. Ingersoll. One last question. When did you have that stroke?
In 2006.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. No further questions, sir, Mr. Moore.
Any questions from the board? Mr. Johnson.
Sir, I just wanted to ask you about a statement. I don't know if you recall, but when you were talking to Mr. Neal, you made a statement, "I believe I know what happened." Do you recall making that statement, sir?
If it's in reference to how Bob died, yeah, I believe I do. To this day, I can explain to you what I can justify. I don't know what the deal is, but I do not remember killing Bob.
So
I remember arguing with him, and I remember that I remember what the weapon being fired. I remember the sound of the shot. But I do not don't know what it is, because I'm shooting, and I don't know how to do it anymore. I don't know what I'm standing with the law, but I'm not, you know. After this stroke, I have all these, you know, these rules. And but, you know, when I put the whole bags, and I was like, well, you killed me, that's all. And, you know, I'm not smart enough or knowledgeable enough or educated enough to explain to you or myself what the circumstances are. The bottom of the camera, I just can't even release. You know, it's not to make it seem like you were being what I did.
Okay. So after it happened,
I'm explaining it to you, sir.
Okay. Thank you, sir. But after it happened, you remember telling your friend Jeff that you had killed the victim?
No. Jeff was told that he was going to give up. He knew that I killed him out, and he was going to give up that shit. And under the circumstances of what happened, the police were all around us. That morning, he had picked me up, and he was going to drive us to. And it was, he had talked to the police before, they were there, that's all in the documentation. And he kept asking me what happened, and I was telling him that I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And we got on the restaurant, we got in the car, we went and parked in the parking lot, we had a discussion. He said he was going to help me, and we went down to the police station, and he told him I confessed to it.
Okay.
And I did not confess to it.
Okay.
This guy was a criminal, had a criminal history too, you know?
Uh-huh.
He wasn't a sweet, wonderful boy. He was a drug addict too. We were in the middle of the drug addict. He had his own issues. I do not remember killing Bob. And this guy had told the police before he ever even talked to me, he was going to get a confession from me. Bob Henley Jr. is who I killed. Bob Henley Sr. then Jim Katz is the guy who said I could kiss him, had been a sponsor. He felt that he had a duty to, you know, find Bob's killer, however you want to describe it. This guy was a religious fellow, you know, the program to confess, you know, he's alive.
Okay, let me ask you just one more question. So you got a ticket in July of 18 for disrupting count, and I guess there was a lockdown in the yard and you were someplace else in medical, is that right, or what happened? Hello? Mr. Ingersoll?
Did he freeze?
He's frozen.
Screen froze. Temporarily go off the record the hearing of Mr. John Ingersoll.